Chapter 2 Power Lines. Who rules Los Angeles? There is no power structure here, only people who think they are it. Otis Chandler. Popular images of power in Los Angeles are curiously contradictory. On the one hand is the common belief, almost folk legend, that L.A. is ruled by an omnipotent downtown establishment, headed by the Times and some big banks, oil companies, and department stores. On the other hand is Chandler's lofty avowal, echoed by journalists, of the "there is no there-there school," that power in Southern California is fragmented and dispersed, without a hegemonic center. Both images exploit partial truths. For the half-century between the Spanish-American and Korean Wars, the Otis Chandler dynasty of the Times did preside over one of the most centralized, indeed militarized, municipal power structures in the United States. They erected the open shop on the bones of labor, expelled pioneer Jews from the social register, and looted the region through one great real estate syndication after another. Important residues of their power, and looting, remain inscribed in downtown, influencing the present Bradley regime, even if the old guard is being supplanted by more powerful players from Tokyo, Toronto, and New York. At the same time, the great-grandson of General Harrison Gray Otis is correct to emphasize the current uncertainty of who rules L.A. Beginning with the rise of enclaved entertainment and aircraft industries in the 1920s and 1930s, and the decentralization of business along the Wilshire Corridor during the same period, the Chandlerian power structure, which gave much of the darkness to L.A. Noir, rapidly lost its regional monopoly. A separatist, predominantly Jewish and democratic West Side, wove its distinctive social and political networks into a competing hierarchy of power. More recently, the globalization of the regional economy has introduced new actors and power centers, destabilizing old-fashioned patrician cultures. Obviously, the poly-centered complexity of the contemporary system of elites is no longer susceptible to the diktat of any single dynasty or Mr. Big. But if Los Angeles has long ceased being a hick town with a single executive committee of the ruling class, it is still far from being a mere gridwork of diffused wealth and power. Political power in Southern California remains organized by great constellations of private capital, which, as elsewhere, act as the permanent government in local affairs. What is exceptional about Los Angeles is the extreme development of what remains merely tendential in the evolution of other American cities. First of all, elite formation in Los Angeles has tended to obey the rules laid down by the region's unpredictable geology, as sudden shifts in the economic base produce fundamental recompositions at the level of power blocks. Despite the interlude of Chandlerian business discipline, Los Angeles has always had a far more porous elite culture than New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, or San Francisco. As Frederick Yarr emphasizes, each new wave of wealth has imposed its ways on the community rather than defer to older elites. This intrusive imperialism now operates in favor of the Japanese Tsaibatsu and Manhattan-based banks, as it did briefly but spectacularly for the recently deposed junk bond kings of Beverly Hills. Secondly, elite genealogy in Los Angeles has reversed the typical American sequence of WASP dominance followed by Catholic and Jewish bids at power. Here, the early preeminence of non-Protestant elites was superseded by a long era of WASP exclusionism, as once cosmopolitan Los Angeles became, culturally and demographically, the most nativist and fundamentalist of big cities. The social and political purge of elite Jews in particular precipitated a bifurcated ruling class, perhaps unique in the United States. Thirdly, the sprawling character of the city's modern development, which already by 1925 anticipated the general tendency of American urbanism in the 1960s, weakened the crucial spatial integuments of a centralized municipal establishment. Since World War I, an increasingly self-identified downtown elite has been trying to prevent power leaks outward and to reinforce the regional centrality of the old central business district. This has only led to an escalation of Darwinian place wars, as new centers and their elites, from Century City to Orange County's Golden Triangle, have challenged the squirearchy of downtown L.A. Moreover, the extreme political fragmentation of the metropolis, surpassing even balkanized Greater Chicago or Boston, has allowed powerful private interests to capture local governments for selfish use as tax-proof enclaves. This competitive marketplace of municipalities, celebrated by ultra-laissez-faire public choice theorists, has reduced the incentive for comprehensive elite organization on a regional scale. Fourthly, the internationalization of class formation has recently made a quantum leap in Los Angeles beyond any other North American city. The most waspish of big cities in 1960, Los Angeles now contains more polyethnic diversity than New York, with a huge manual working class of Latinos and a growing rentier stratum of Asian investors. On an elite-level Japanese capital, arriving like a tsunami in the early 1980s, has already become a discreet but major player in city politics. Meanwhile, great waves of Chinese, Korean, and Armenian middle-class immigrants, augmented by Israelis, Iranians, and others, have made Los Angeles the most dynamic center of ethnic family capitalism on the planet. Finally, because mass politics are so extraordinarily stunted in Los Angeles, elite interest brokerage is transacted invisibly with minimum patronage costs or trickle-down to inner city or labor constituencies, except for the periods immediately following the defeat of the open shop in the late 1930s and the Watts Rebellion of 1965. Modern Los Angeles power structures have not had to respond to significant reformist pressures from the left. This is partly the perverse legacy of local early 20th century progressivism, which, by eliminating partisan competition in city and county governments, depreciated citizen participation. It is also the result of extreme racial gerrymandering, especially of the Chicano East Side, which has historically diluted the political clout of the non-Anglo working class. More recently, the tide of undocumented immigration from Mexico and Central America has magnified the discrepancy between who labors and who votes. Despite the epical demographic transition that has made Anglos a minority group in Los Angeles, the most significant constraint on elite decision-making comes from affluent Anglo homeowners, see Chapter 3, whose electoral weight is greater than ever. Although other American cities betray some of these tendencies, that is, Faustian economic restructuring, social porosity, elite anti-Semitism, central place competitions, internationalization of class formation, extreme political fragmentation, and disenfranchisement of the inner city, none, to borrow the city's official slogan, brings it all together like Los Angeles. The most permanent boomtown in American history, Los Angeles has always been the Great Gatsby of American cities. Through the ebb and flow of individual fortunes, the real city-making will of Los Angeles has been incarnated in a succession of power structures made coherent by common accumulation strategies and distinguished by specific modes of insertion into the larger power structures of the Californian and national, today international, economies. In almost every case, moreover, the new strategies and elites have been generated by restructurings of the political economy of land development. As a general rule, changing modes of land speculation have tended to determine the nature of Los Angeles's power structures. In the genealogy that follows, I sketch a generational narrative of power elites framed within a tripartite periodization, according to historically dominant modes of land development. First, in the century from the declaration of the Bear Flag Republic to the surrender of Japan, that is, across the long arc of manifest destiny, Los Angeles grew from an insignificant Mexican pueblo of fewer than 3,000 souls to a metropolis of over 3 million. In this first century of Anglo rule, development remained fundamentally latifundian, and ruling strata were organized as speculative land monopolies, whose ultimate incarnation was the militarized power structure established by General Otis, which controlled the city for almost three generations after 1889. By the end of World War II, however, it became impossible to speak of a single hegemonic power structure, as Los Angeles was increasingly polarized between downtown and west side growth coalitions, with competing economic, political, and cultural pretensions. In an era of Keynesian suburbanization, merchant building and home mortgage industries generated much of the West Side's rising power, while the Chandlerian old guard remained fixated on the redevelopment of their downtown patrimonies. Although militant uprisings of the inner city encouraged a certain rapprochement between Jewish and Gentile business leaderships, ironically represented in the liberal Bradley regime, Los Angeles remained effectively a city with two heads until the 1980s. During the last decade, increasing land scarcity has interacted with the arrival of Asian investment to initiate a far-reaching recomposition of traditional elites. As the second city of a vast Pacific Rim co-prosperity sphere dominated by Tokyo, Los Angeles has become both imperium and colony. Parochial power struggles between downtown and the West Side have been overshadowed by new geopolitics and land economics, leaving the problem of who will rule Los Angeles in the year 2000 a surprisingly open question. Sunshine and the Open Shop. Scheming Sons-in-Law, 1840s to 1850s. If, in Northern California, the armies of gold seekers brutally overran the native Californio society, in the South, the preferred weapon of conquest was marriage. The old haciendados of the Los Angeles region, the gente de razón, whom we recall today principally by picturesque street names, Pico, Figueroa, Sepulveda, and so on, were nonviolently dispossessed by their own scheming Yankee sons-in-law. In the late 1820s, Mexican Alta California, particularly the rich rangelands around missions San Gabriel and San Fernando, which were the object of a protracted struggle between the church and secularizing land grantees, became a maritime colony of Boston. Hides from the great ranchos provided the leather for the shoe factories of New England's Industrial Revolution, while Yankee traders furnished the rudiments of Victorian civilization to the remote Southern California coast. As clipper ships became a regular sight in the Catalina Channel, however, more than one sailor was enchanted by the possibilities of life ashore, especially by the lucrative opportunities to grasp the commercial intermediary roles disdained by the indigenous ranchers. One of the earliest, and eventually the most successful of these Yankee ship jumpers, was Don Abel Stearns, who arrived in the late 1820s, and after a politic conversion to Catholicism, became the son-in-law of Juan Bandini, a leading landowner. His Massachusetts compatriot, Juan Temple, opened Los Angeles's first store, and scored an even bigger coup by marrying the daughter of Manuel Nieto, the greatest cattle baron in the province, whose ranges extended from the San Gabriel to the Santa Ana Rivers. A score of other Yankees, as well as a handful of vagabond Europeans, followed the matrimonial trail of fortune blazed by Stearns and Temple. By the eve of the conquest, and before the arrival of any of Polk's dragoons, the economy of Southern California had already been decisively Americanized by intermarriage, with Stearns, looking in his daguerreotypes every inch the Old Testament patriarch, the wealthiest man in Alta California, and the master of Los Angeles's foreign commerce. Although the decline of the hide trade and the War of Conquest temporarily depressed the rancho economy, the gold rush stimulated an almost insatiable demand for beef to feed 100,000 placer miners. As the price of range cattle increased from $2 to $50 per head, Stearns and the Anglo-Californians waxed in power and wealth. Then, during the Civil War, catastrophe struck. First, a devastating drought that left the bones of a million cattle bleaching the hillsides of Los Angeles County. Secondly, the introduction of stock raising, using improved breeds, in the southern San Joaquin Valley by the famous cattle baron and land pirate Henry Miller. Visionaries dreamt of vast irrigation works to revive the Southern California economy, but there was no local capital. Heavily in debt, with their stock destroyed and trapped in decades-long litigation of their land titles, the haciendados began to lose control of their patrimonies. Northern Carpetbaggers, 1860s to 1870s. The destruction of Southern California's cattle-based economy contrasted with the soaring wealth of San Francisco resulting from the silver bonanza in the Comstock and the building of the Central Pacific Railroad. While the gold rush itself failed to leave behind a well-defined California ruling class, the corporate exploitation of the Comstock and the Federal Railroad subsidies land grants created an independent pole of capital in San Francisco, ruling over a Pacific Slope empire from the Aleutians to Baja. It was this fabled Medicean San Francisco of Ralston's Ring, the Big Four, and the Comstock Kings, which, after the end of the Civil War, invaded the Los Angeles region and reshaped its economy. San Francisco capital arrived in two separate contingents. Early in the gold rush days, German-Jewish merchants from Silesia and Alsace began to wrest control of Los Angeles's commerce from Stearns and the Anglo-Californians. By the late 1860s, when Isaias W. Hellman, destined to be Los Angeles's greatest Gilded Age financier, opened the doors of his first bank, these merchant families had integrated Southern California into a vast financial commercial network spread across most of the West. Controlled from San Francisco, usually via a division of labor between older and younger brothers, and linked internationally to capital centers in New York, Paris, and Frankfurt. Exploiting the drought-induced collapse of land values to 10 cents per acre, the entire assessed valuation of all of Los Angeles County was only $1.6 million in 1863, a second stream of nouveau riche Comstock millionaires and wealthy retainers of the Central Pacific Railroad began to buy up the bankrupt ranchos of the South. The transition between eras and ruling groups was dramatically marked by the liquidation, in 1868, of the ruined estate of Abel Stearns. A syndicate of San Francisco investors led by Alfred Robinson and Sam Brannan, the famous Mormon vigilante of the 1850s, subdivided the great domain stretching from San Pedro to San Bernardino. William Clary, historian of the O'Melveny legal dynasty, which battened off the sale of the ranchos, points out that the Stearns sale set the pattern for all future California real estate promotions. It was the first time that a systematic attempt was made to promote nationally the climatic and other attractions of Southern California. Within a decade of the breakup of the Stearns empire, virtually every major land grant, with a signal exception of the Dominguez Rancho in the South Bay, had been alienated to Northern California interests. The Long Beach area to Bixby and Flint, who bought out Juan Temple, Southern Orange County to Irvine and Flood, later O'Neill, Catalina Island to Lick, a brace of ranches in the San Gabriel Valley to Lucky Baldwin, the Santa Clara Valley of the South to Newhall, the Southern San Fernando to Lancashire and Van Nuys, the Northern San Fernando to the Porter brothers and McClay, while Senator Jones of Nevada became the father of Santa Monica. Still lacking in irrigation infrastructure, there was little market for the subdivision of these vast holdings into farms. Forced to preserve their latifundia intact for another generation, the Northerners experimented with sheep raising, then, after wool prices slumped, with bonanza wheat and barley farming. This generated a novel maritime commerce for Los Angeles as flour from the San Fernando Valley was shipped around the Horn to Liverpool. The chief profiteers from the sale of the ranchos were Isaias Hellman and his partner, ex-Governor John Downey, who, through shrewd usury during the drought years, came to hold liens on the choicest properties. In 1871, they founded the Farmers and Merchants Bank, which for 30 years was the city's leading financial center. The collaboration of Hellman and Downey, which survived even the former's capture of control of the bank in 1875, symbolized a broader ethnic coexistence. Many of the carpetbaggers were Irish, Downey, O'Neill, O'Melveny, Baldwin, and so on. And interestingly, as in San Francisco, they tended to form easy alliances with the German-Jewish merchant community. The two groups entrenched themselves in the all-powerful local Democratic Party, and the Jews, in stark contrast to their exclusion in the next century, regularly participated in all the insignia of municipal power, from the city council to the vigilance committee's frequent necktie parties. Today, in the Little Masonic Museum in El Pueblo Historical Park, a visitor can still find abundant evidence in membership lists, period portraits, and testimonials of the ecumenical commingling of elites during the 1870s. As Remy Nadeau has documented, the first coordinated initiative of this new ruling class, the centerpiece of their common accumulation strategy, was lobbying to make Los Angeles the primary rail center of the Southwest. After the collapse of the Rancho economy, the city had been saved by its commerce with the silver camps of Cerro Gordo and the Panamint Mountains near Death Valley. As the Southern Pacific built its way down the San Joaquin Valley in the early 1870s, Los Angeles leaders feared that one of the new valley railheads might siphon off this essential bullion trade. Looking further ahead, the local backers of the Southern Pacific, SP, led by banker Hellman and lawyer O'Melveny, hoped to preempt San Diego's bid to become Southern California's transcontinental railroad terminus. Although the SP extorted extravagant land and cash subsidies to build a spur to the Los Angeles River, Hellman and O'Melveny overrode railroad critics with glittering visions of the prosperity imminently in the wake of the Iron Horse. Otis and the Boomers, 1880s through 1910s. The railroad was, at first, a cruel disappointment, demanding much in tribute and delivering little in new trade. While Los Angeles, population 11,183 in 1880, waited 7 long years for the SP to complete its southern branch through New Orleans, local produce had to be routed through Ogden, where fruit shipments perished in the cold of the high passes. As late as 1883, local seers envisioned a purely parochial future. Ostrich raising was still described as a prominent industry, and naturalist John Muir saw the region's best hope in beekeeping. The completion of the SP's Sunset Route in 1883, followed by the arrival of the competing Santa Fe in 1886, transformed the geographic and economic setting of Southern California. With immense investments tied up in the new transcontinental lines, and as the region's largest landowners, the railroads acquired a huge stake in the rapid development of Los Angeles and adjoining counties. Eager to show off the charms of its new fiefdom, the SP once offered Oscar Wilde a special train and private car if he would visit Los Angeles. On a scale hitherto not dreamt possible, they created a growth blueprint based on the conversion of latifundian dry agriculture into subdivided irrigated horticulture. As Richard Orsi has emphasized, by the early 1880s, the railroads were the leading patrons of scientific farming in California. Citrus culture, especially, seemed an ideal development strategy, attracting thousands of affluent investors, raising land values, reinforcing the region's Mediterranean image, promoting tourism, stimulating town building, and above all, dramatically raising the unit value of railroad shipments. To realize this vision, the railroads allied their immigration and advertising departments, their land agents and tourist bureaus, to local promotional forces. As the SP and Santa Fe began a rate-cutting war in 1886, Los Angeles, a mystery place to most Americans, suddenly became the urgent destination of around 100,000 land speculators and curious tourists. As the San Jose Times-Mercury complained, the average Eastern mind now conceives of California as a small tract of country situated in and about Los Angeles. As we saw in the previous chapter, the boom of 1886 through 9 was a human frenzy not unlike the gold rush of 1849. A contemporary observer said, "It looked as if the whole human family were coming here to live, on climate and swapping corner lots." In 1887 alone, 2,000 real estate agents transacted over $100 million in land sales, several times the region's previous net value, and 60 new towns were laid out, mostly along competing railroad routes. Although the boom abruptly collapsed in 1889, turning many millionaires of a day into paupers, it left behind an impressive infrastructure of irrigation districts and suburban traction companies, heavily financed by San Francisco and Chicago capital, as well as 50,000 new residents. The British vice consul, surveying the wreckage of the boom in early 1890, noted that the chief obstacle to Los Angeles's renewed growth was the pitiable state of its harbor, the wholly unimproved and unprotected anchorage at San Pedro. Conditions there were so bad, particularly during the season when the southeastern gales blew, that Los Angeles was forced to use New Orleans, via the Sunset Route, as an alternative port. As historian William Issel has pointed out, it was the Free Harbor fight during the 1890s, simultaneously waged for federal subsidies to improve San Pedro and against Southern Pacific's scheme for a captive port at Santa Monica, that stimulated the emergence of a group of leaders who rapidly came to regard themselves as the city's natural leadership class. The chief organizer of the Free Harbor League, of course, was General Otis, who welded together the natural ruling class of the 1890s, while simultaneously making the Times, the only one of four dailies to unequivocally support the municipal harbor, the leading paper in the region. Many of the carpetbaggers of the previous generation, like Linkersham, Cole, and Slauson, who had sided with the SP, never recovered the power they lost as a result of the Free Harbor victory. Their successors included two very distinctive strata of newcomers. On the one hand were the professional developers working with the railroads, Hobart Whitley, Moses Sherman, Eli Clark, H.L. Wilcox, and so on, who had followed the Western land boom to its final frontier on the Pacific. On the other hand was an odd coterie of refugee Easterners, mostly from Brahmin backgrounds, who, whether from illness, Dwight Willard and Harry Chandler were consumptives, or from business failure, Otis, as we have seen, was a disappointed federal office seeker, had come out to Los Angeles seeking their last chance. Although this composite elite was scarcely more than a defeated band of land speculators, under Otis's slogan of "A New Beginning," they launched the most ambitious city-building program in American history. With the immodest ambition of surpassing San Francisco in a generation, they kept Los Angeles on a war footing, fully mobilized for self-promotion and improvement. Their chief allies, of course, remained the railroads, and it is indicative of transcendent common interests that, even while the Free Harbor League was battling the SP, the Chamber of Commerce, dominated by the same personages, was cooperating with the Octopus to promote Los Angeles in the East. All sides agreed that the realization of the ultimate speculator's dream, the subdivision of the great Southern California Latifundia, required the construction of an immense artificial infrastructure. Critics, especially San Franciscans, mocked the hubris that declared Los Angeles one of the world's great cities in the making. Yet within 20 years, a Bismarckian municipal will, manifest in both public works and private monopoly, had created the world's biggest man-made port, aqueduct, and interurban electric railroad system. The same iron will, as we have seen, also smashed the labor movement in Los Angeles with the aim of giving the Otis-organized Merchants and Manufacturers Association a competitive advantage over their regional rivals in Union Citadel San Francisco. Permanent class warfare also reinforced bourgeois political discipline. When middle-class progressives, the Good Government League, or GooGoos, attempted to break away from the strictly Otistown vision of Los Angeles's future, they were driven back into line by the dramatic 1909-12 electoral gains of the Socialist Party, which captured both working-class resentment against the open shop and anti-progressive support from the Southern Pacific machine. In its inner logic, this third-generation power structure resembled a McKinleyite version of the Cosa Nostra. At the pinnacle of regional power were two families of speculators headed by rival godfathers. On one side was the Times dynasty of Otis and his son-in-law Harry Chandler. On the other side was the Pacific Electric mob, the alliance of Isaias Hellman and Henry Huntington, which also included San Francisco millionaires Christian De Gein and Antoine Borel. Hellman, the principal carryover from the Ancien Régime of the 1870s, had moved to San Francisco in 1890 to run the Wells Fargo Bank, but continued, even at a distance, to dominate Los Angeles finance until his death in 1920. In particular, he helped S.P. Air Huntington finance the consolidation of the region's suburban railroads into the fabled Pacific Electric system. Hellman and Huntington, two of the richest men in the West, loathed General Otis, and it is interesting to speculate what might have been the consequence of an all-out war between their rival factions. Instead, the Godfathers kept the peace by sharing with each other the super profits of Los Angeles's next boom. Manipulating water politics and captive city officials, Otis, Chandler, Hellman, and Huntington, along with a score of other leading capitalists, including even Christian socialist John Randolph Haynes, joined in syndicates to monopolize the subdivision of Hollywood, the San Fernando Valley, and much of northeastern Los Angeles. As Town and Polanski's Chinatown suggests, in a history more syncretic than fictional, the windfall profits of these operations welded the ruling class together and capitalized lineages of power, notably the Times Mirror Empire, that remain in place today. Harry Chandler's Town, 1920s to 1940s. After the death of Otis in 1917, Harry Chandler, sitting on more than 50 corporation boards, emerged as the unquestioned leader of LA's fourth-generation Anglo power structure. The generalissimo of the forces that engineered the great post-war boom. Indeed, Los Angeles in the 1920s was in many respects a de facto dictatorship of the Times and the Merchants and Manufacturers Association, as the LAPD's infamous Red Squad kept dissent off the streets and radicals in jail. The social base of this authoritarian regime was the great influx of Middle Western babbitry between 1900 and 1925, one of the great internal migrations of American history. In an era when transatlantic immigration was making most big U.S. cities more foreign-born, Catholic and Jewish, Los Angeles's non-Protestant white population was in relative decline. Moreover, the new WASP ascendancy found its essential economic support in the arrival of Mexican labor in massive numbers after the fall of the Porfiriato in 1910. Evoking Los Angeles in 1920, Robert Fogelson describes an ethnic polarization which, except for the dramatic reversal between majority and minority populations, prefigured the city of the 1990s. Unlike most eastern and midwestern metropolises, which were divided between Native Americans and European immigrants, Los Angeles was divided between an overwhelming native white majority and a sizable colored minority. Nowhere on the Pacific coast, not even in cosmopolitan San Francisco, was there so diverse a mixture of racial groups, so visible a contrast, and so pronounced a separation among people in the 1920s. One of the first casualties of this recomposition of demography and power was the integrated social status of Los Angeles Jews. By the early 1900s, elite Jews, including the pioneer dynasties of the 1840s and 1850s, were being excluded from the corporate directorships, law firms, philanthropies, and clubs that in many cases they had helped to establish. At the same time, Jewish financial preeminence, represented by Hellman's Farmers and Merchants Bank, which also regrouped remnants of the 1870s Gentile elite, declined in the face of the steady rise of the regional branch banking empires led by Joseph Sartori, Security Bank, and Henry Robinson, First National. The Jewish Old Guard, faced with growing anti-Semitism on all sides, began a defensive withdrawal into its own segregated elite culture, represented first by the Concordia Club, followed by the Hillcrest Country Club. Catholic capitalists, interdependent with a local democratic machine, also retreated in the face of the economic hegemony of the Chandler clique and the political supremacy of militant Protestantism. The once mighty Southern California Democratic Party, led in its 1890s heyday by Senator Stephen White, the hero of the Free Harbor fight, was reduced to quarrelsome, ineffectual cabals in the era of one-party Republican government. Its fractious disarray exposed the competition of several sub-elites, divided by religion and petroleum. Thus, on one side was the Catholic rump of the old party machine, led by Isadora Duckweiler, railroad lawyer and holdover from the days of the SP Octopus. On the other side was a gaggle of Wilsonian carpetbaggers who had moved to Los Angeles during the early 1920s real estate and oil booms, in the hope of repairing their fallen fortunes. They were led by the late president's son-in-law, William Gibbs McAdoo, who, driven from New York by the popularity of Al Smith, mobilized a constituency of Southern Democrats, ex-Bryanites, and the Ku Klux Klan, then waxing in power throughout Southern California. Although oil man Edward Doheny, of Teapot Dome infamy, was the most prominent Catholic in Los Angeles, he heavily financed McAdoo, presumably because the latter was even more passionately pro-oil than anti-Catholic. At the 1924 Democratic Convention, Smith supporters in the balcony constantly jeered, "Oil, oil, oil," at every mention of McAdoo. Indeed, Southern California, in the oil-crazed 1920s, was a land of blue-eyed sheiks, some of whom formed a new stratum of the Chandlerian ruling class, while others ended up filling cells in San Quentin. But even oil speculation, in the fiercely anti-Semitic climate of the period, was organized via the financial equivalents of restrictive covenants or segregated drinking fountains. During the Julian Petroleum frenzy, the biggest and phoniest of the promotions, separate stock pools were set aside for Jewish and Gentile capital. Unsurprisingly, when the bubble burst and the underlying swindle was exposed, wiping out thousands of investors and plunging Southern California into a recession, the prosecution focused on a few Jewish scapegoats, refusing to follow obvious leads, pointing, as we saw in the last chapter, to banker Henry Robinson and other members of the WASP establishment. As a school for scandal, only the downtown construction boom rivaled the oil rush. When the Otis, Chandler, Hellman, Huntington syndicates bought out the latifundistas of the San Fernando Valley, the latter plowed their capital gains into downtown real estate. Their eponymous skyscrapers, the Van Nuys, Lancashire, San Fernando, and so on, dominated the skyline until the early 1920s, when in turn the fourth generation began to shift the spoils of their suburban speculations into a new expansion of downtown. Chandler led the syndicates that financed the Biltmore Hotel with Letts and the Chaffees, and the subway terminal building with Sartori, as well as promoting improvements, Coliseum, Union Station, Civic Center, and so on, that reinforced downtown property values in general. But neither the oil nor downtown booms, nor for that matter oranges and movies, provided an adequate economic foundation for Los Angeles's dramatic ascent during the 1920s to become the nation's fourth largest metropolitan district. Homegrown wealth and commerce were insufficient to support the region's lavish superstructures of consumption, tertiary employment, and geriatrics. As Upton Sinclair noted, Los Angeles was fundamentally parasitic on prosperity produced in other regions, a kind of cloud society, like Swift's Laputa, levitated by the influx of wealthy migrants and retirees from the heartland. Chandler and other fourth-generation leaders, like Sartori and Robinson, were acutely aware that the real estate growth machine created by the previous generation required continuous transfers of savings from the rest of the country. Although the All-Year Club, under Chandler's directorship, launched a massive campaign in the 1920s to keep affluent immigrants and tourists coming westward, there was universal elite agreement that what Los Angeles needed most was industry. As the Times itself polemicized, Los Angeles has existed for too long with an economic base of local real estate and building interests. We need more factories, new industries, and more interstate commerce and the development of foreign trade. With the Times's proprietor again in the saddle, the open shop forces crusaded to attract European corporations to Los Angeles's sunny land of industrial freedom. By 1930, they had wooed scores of corporate branch plants and nearly 50,000 new manufacturing jobs to the county. Yet the Chandlerian power structure was ultimately defeated by its own successes. Each of its major accumulation strategies, that is, the recapitalization of downtown and the promotion of branch plant industry, brought unexpected consequences that weakened or diffused its hegemony. For example, the conversion of so much of the elite's patrimony into downtown real estate failed to anticipate the centrifugal influence of Southern California's precocious automobilization, which already by 1925 had attained a density, one car per 1.6 persons, which the rest of the nation would not reach until the late 1950s. By entangling downtown streetcar lines in a gridlocked conflict over right-of-way, while simultaneously offering harassed commuters the option of virtually unlimited personal mobility outside the central business district, the automobile subverted downtown's central place monopoly and created windfall profit opportunities for the developers of the first suburban auto-centered shopping complexes. Indeed, by the late 1920s, downtown forces were embroiled in a losing battle to prevent A.W. Ross from establishing his Miracle Mile on Wilshire Boulevard's west side, while middle-class suburbanization in the direction of the ocean began to disperse traditional central business district CBD functions along a Wilshire axis, downtown's share of retail trade plummeting from 90% in 1920 to 17% in 1950, the inclusive real estate syndicate system, so essential to elite cohesion in the previous generation, collapsed. Just as the city became more decentralized, so too did control over its major profit-making activity, the subdivision of the suburban frontier. The fourth-generation elite, now self-consciously defined as a downtown establishment, would struggle in vain for the next 40 years to recenter growth around their enormous fixed investments in the CBD. Industrialization undermined their power in more subtle ways. The branch plants were the maquiladoras of the 1920s, usually located in manufacturing zones outside the city limits and assembling parts shipped in from the east. Save for Chandler's ties to Donald Douglas and Warner Brothers, Frederick Yarr has found little evidence of the integration of local and outside capital. In fact, the major financing in the direction of these ventures emanated usually from banks and corporations based mostly on the Atlantic coast. Likewise, half the oil industry production was controlled by huge national corporations, and the leading independents were run largely by recent arrivals. Hollywood, encompassing also the movie enclaves in Burbank, Universal City, and Culver City, exemplified this growing disjuncture between regional economic power and the downtown-oriented elite. The most important fact about the movie colony was not so much its financial domination by Wall Street and the Bank of Italy, but simply that it was headed by Eastern European Jews, who, despite their legendary wealth and conservative politics, could not play golf or send their kids to the same schools with the Chandlerian elite. Even Louis B. Mayer, during the 1930s, the chairman of the California Republican Party and the highest-paid executive in the United States, was excluded from social inner sanctums enjoyed by middle-level WASP realtors and used car dealers. The Hochdeutsch Jewish clans like the Hellmans and Newmarks were initially disdainful of Hollywood's vulgar nouveau riche, but they were gradually reconciled by the common pressures of anti-Semitism and the reinvigorating wealth of the movie moguls. The Hillcrest Country Club, founded in 1920 on the edge of Beverly Hills in the Fox Studios, was the melting pot of new and old Jewish elites, where the ingredients for a future West Side power structure were first combined. As Neil Gabler explains, the Hollywood Jews at Hillcrest were also rearranging the power configurations within the Jewish community. Hillcrest not only signified the grudging acceptance of the Hollywood Jews by the German Jews, whose power was in any case declining by the time the Depression hit, Hillcrest forged an alliance between these groups. A city with two heads. The enclave manufacturing economy proved to be the Trojan horse of Otis Town. As early as 1927, Hollywood opened a breach in employer ranks by accepting the Studio Master Agreement with unions. Later, auto and tire branch plants would impose national contracts and labor standards. The open shop, in any case, was being closed down by a strange municipal reform movement that united Latter-day Goo-Goos with the CIO to sweep away civic corruption and anti-picketing laws. Despite the dire warnings from the Better America Federation and other fronts for the Merchants and Manufacturers Association that unionization would turn Los Angeles back into a desert, the war in the Pacific arrived in time to bring the region its real industrial revolution. Although it is doubtful if Harry Chandler or any of his wealthy friends recognized much in the name Keynes, beyond the dimly perceived bugaboo of British socialism, the Los Angeles economy in the 1940s was being Keynesianized in its own peculiar fashion. First, the interregional capital flows that had been the source of Southern California's prosperity were now institutionalized in national defense appropriations that shifted tax resources from the rest of the country to irrigate the Los Angeles area's aircraft plants and military bases. A huge regional subsidy that in later years was estimated to average $17 to $20 billion per annum. Secondly, the land conversion process, already raised to an economy of scale by pre-war syndicates and developers, was now transformed into a true mass production industry. Federally guaranteed mortgages, veterans benefits, and a protected savings and loan sector, along with the higher wages of the aircraft plants, provided a stable mass demand for the products of local merchant builders, who industrialized land assembly and construction in the infant suburbs of the San Fernando Valley and the southeastern coastal plain. These new structures of accumulation transformed conditions for the reproduction of elite power. The militarization of the Los Angeles economy conferred the largest single quotient of economic power upon enclaved aircraft corporations, financed from Wall Street and historically indifferent to the fate of downtown. At the same time, the strategic position of the savings and loan industry within the post-war housing revolution opened up new power roles for ethnic and political outsiders. Fortunately, Harry Chandler, who died in 1944 at age 80, wasn't around to witness the slow unraveling of his ancien regime. The West Side Emerges, 1950s. In the reconversion period, 1944 through 7, the Chandlerian generation of downtown leaders began to be replaced by their sons and protégés. The most prominent circle had been chums of Norman Chandler since college days in the 1920s. Bud Haldeman, whose father was an open shop leader and whose son would star in Watergate, Preston Hotchkiss, the Bixby Ranch heir, John McCone, future CIA chief, and Reese Taylor, eventually president of Union Oil. But these grandsons of the 19th century boosters would not themselves be the architects of the great suburban boom of the 1950s. Their structural position in the Southern California economy was increasingly that of a classical rentier stratum, preoccupied with the cultivation of patrimonies, especially their common stake in downtown. Moreover, the tired blood or spoiled rich boy syndrome, which seemingly afflicts all dynasties after the second generation, made them dependent upon their father's henchmen or their wives. Indeed, the actual direction of the affairs of the downtown elite during the 1950s was a hybrid of matriarchy and regency. Norman Chandler, although nominally the heir to the throne, left the generalship of protracted struggles to his father's chief proxy, Kyle Palmer, whom David Halberstam judged the political boss of California between 1930 and 1960. Or alternately to his ambitious wife, Buffy. According to Halberstam, Buffy learned about power dealing literally through listening at the keyhole, as her father-in-law did business with Herbert Hoover. Another one of Harry Chandler's old associates, insurance executive Asa Call, also played Mr. Big roles opposite Palmer and Mrs. Chandler. He was usually assisted by O'Melveny and Myers' partner, James Lynn Beebe, and furniture merchant Neil Petrie. Later, when the Republican elite began to split up between old right and new right wings, oilman Henry Salvatore emerged as the eminence grise of the most conservative camp. This sclerotic power block, increasingly reliant upon a Ptolemaic system of lobbyists and retainers, made three major moves in the late 1940s and 1950s to repair its declining hegemony. First, Beebe and Petrie, as heads of the Chamber of Commerce's powerful Traffic and Transit Committee, launched a plan in 1948 to integrate rail rapid transit into a radial downtown-centered freeway grid. The Chamber's aim was to protect CBD property values by reinforcing downtown's transit centrality, in this case to capture the retail trade of the burgeoning San Fernando Valley, before another entrepreneur repeated A.W. Ross's 1920s feat of creating an alternative suburban shopping complex. Although rail rapid transit now was endorsed by hundreds of downtown businessmen, as well as by larger San Fernando Valley developers. It was condemned as socialistic by a counter-coalition composed of West Side developers, outlying commercial interests, including the proprietors of the new Crenshaw Shopping Center, the Wilshire and Miracle Mile Chambers of Commerce, the Los Angeles Realty Board, and independent cities like Long Beach and Santa Monica. In the end, this suburban united front turned a narrow majority of the city council against the chamber's plan, an astonishing defeat of downtown leadership in the opinion of the episode's historian. Aided by local McCarthyism, the old guard was more successful in 1953 in restoring a pliant Toms-dominated regime in City Hall. The pretext of their municipal counter-revolution was the creeping socialism, their turn to make the accusation, of Mayor Fletcher Bowron's low-rent public housing program, especially where it cut across elite plans for downtown, as in Chavez Ravine or, potentially, Bunker Hill. What Bowron would later denounce as a small, immensely wealthy, incredibly powerful group, i.e. Chandler, Call, Petrie, and Beeb, drafted right-wing Congressman Norris Polson as the torchbearer of their crusade against socialism. According to Gottlieb and Wolt, Polson accepted the nomination only after being assured by Chandler that the mayor was entitled to strut around in a Cadillac and chauffeur supplied by the city. With Norman Chandler's editorial pages pounding away at Bolshevism and public housing, Polson got his ride in the Cadillac. Within a few years, the Times-made mayor, in return, gave the downtown interests what they really wanted, the removal of 12,000 low-income residents to pave the way for Bunker Hill redevelopment and Dodgers Stadium in Chavez Ravine. Exhilarated by their easy recapture of City Hall, Chandler, Palmer, Call, and Company combined forces with their traditional ally, the Noland dynasty of Oakland, to carry the counter-revolution statewide in 1958. The traditional bête noire of old guard Republicanism in California was less the Democratic Party than the hugely popular labor-supported and welfarist regime of liberal Republican Governor Earl Warren, 1942-54. Partially to block Warren's presidential ambitions, the old guard, led by Kyle Palmer and Norman Chandler, engineered the rise of Richard Nixon from Congress to vice presidency. After Warren's elevation to the Supreme Court, Chandler Noland forces focused on trimming the wings of his moderate Republican successor, Goodwin Knight. Their strategy was to force Knight to trade positions with Senator William Noland, who would then use the supposedly stronger base of the governor's mansion for a presidential bid in 1960. In tandem with the Noland campaign, moreover, was a right-to-work initiative, which featured hysterical denunciations of Walter Reuther's threat to California. This blatant overweening attempt to restore the open shop backfired in a historic Democratic landslide led by Pat Brown that buried old guard Republicanism forever. Most shockingly for Los Angeles's downtown elite, the 1958 Republican debacle also signaled the emergence of West Side power centers willing and able to contest their historical monopoly on statewide political influence. One of the old guard's chief grievances with Governor Knight, together with his coddling of labor, was his reliance upon the support of West Side savings and loan king Howard Amundson. Reputedly the richest man in California, Amundson was despised for, apart from his Jewishness, being a pink Republican, too rich to be a Democrat and too liberal to be a true Republican. Knight's attempt to depose state Republican finance chief Asa Call, LA's Mr. Big, and replace him with Amundson, had provoked a final break between the two wings of the party. Yet while Amundson was Knight's financial right hand, he was also quietly bankrolling Jess Unruh, a liberal Democratic assemblyman from South Central Los Angeles, who had intimate connections with younger Jewish Democrats on the West Side. When Knight was humiliatingly forced to cede the gubernatorial candidacy to Noland, Amundson paid Unruh's salary to run Pat Brown's highly successful Southern California campaign. This was the beginning of the celebrated Amundson-Unruh system, whereby West Side money, Bart Litton of Beverly Hills was another major contributor, provided Unruh with the juice to capture the speakership and eventual control of the legislature. With Big Daddy Unruh strategically dispersing savings and loan money to younger Democratic candidates, much of the party's ostensible liberal wing became a satellite of Los Angeles's nouveau riche. Where did the money to buy such power come from? Although some of the new wealth on the West Side arose from the military aerospace boom of the later 1950s, the locus of power, as in previous generations, remained real estate speculation. But as we have stressed, the game was now played within the new rules of Keynesian suburbanization set by the FHA and Fannie Mae. Two rising groups of entrepreneurs dominated the 1950s building boom from their West Side headquarters outside the radius of downtown power. First were the merchant builders, mostly 1940s newcomers, like Nate Chappell, Larry Weinberg, Louis Boyer, Ray Watt, Bill Lyon, and later Eli Broad. Secondly were the savings and loan empires that funneled mortgage capital from all over the country to Southern California homebuilders. In the 1950s, this was an extraordinarily dynamic industry, with a deposit base growing 21% per annum. The preeminent local firms were Amundsen's Home Federal Savings, number one in the USA, and Mark Taper's First Charter Corporation, number three. Moreover, the building and savings and loan sectors were complexly integrated by strategic combinations. For instance, Taper's alliance with Boyer and Weinberg to mass-produce the suburb of Lakewood, as well as by the massive reinvestment of builders' profits in the thrift industry. The rise of this boom-fueled, federally subsidized building and thrift complex on the West Side shifted the ethnic and geographic axis of regional power. Before World War II, only a handful of large developers, most notably Joseph Teplitsky, had been Jewish. After the war, abetted by Jewish immigration to the West Side and Valley, suburb development became virtually a Jewish-dominated industry at both the construction and financial ends. As Vorspan and Gartner note, the Jewish builder replaced the Jewish film magnate as the entrepreneur par excellence. But the builders were less rivals than communal reinforcements to the second-generation studio heirs and movie producers gathered around the Hillcrest Country Club. With the building and thrift and entertainment sectors as two pillars, a growing sportswear industry, financed and integrated by the Jewish-owned Union Bank, completed the tripod of landsman economic power. Moreover, as we saw in the last chapter, in a decade when downtown construction had virtually ceased, the West Side building boom, whether represented by hillside homes or new savings and loan headquarters, generalized architectural modernism as a distinctive emblem of the West Side society dominated by the Jewish elites. Although other American cities may have had plural elites or competing cliques, none could claim a situation so dichotomous on so many levels as the separate upper-class universes of downtown and the West Side.